Xeroxes of a chance. I should have passed them out before we sat. But we have them now for next time. So maybe we just pass them out now so that we don't forget. Pass them around. And also, Bernice Xerox, a nice article by Tanisaro Bhikkhu, this American monk who lives in San Diego. He lives in a forest monastery in San Diego, which is an avocado orchard. And coming down here today, I was reminded of this woman I met in India named Deepa Ma, who you hear about her occasionally from some of the teachers because she was a teacher, one of the teachers for Sharon Salzberg and Joseph and Jack, and everybody kind of went to India, kind of would visit her and hang out with her a little bit. And I met with her. I was in Calcutta. I went to see her at her apartment. And she lived in this, you know, I think she was, you know, I don't think she was completely poor according to Indian standards, but she lived in this little third floor of this little tenement in this narrow little street in Calcutta. And it was the rainy season, and you had to kind of walk through the streets. It was, you know, lots of water, and lots of water means that the gutters are backing up, so you don't know what you're stepping on, and it's quite a mess. And so she was there. You walk up these crickety steps up to the third floor, and she lives there in a one or two room apartment with her daughter and grandchildren, and very, very simple place. And her name is Deepa Ma, and Deepa Ma means Deepa's mother, because she's the mother of Deepa. So that's how she's known. And she was a short, very sweet woman who had practiced in the Mahasi Center in Burma. The meditation practice that we teach primarily, the technique or whatever, comes from this place in Burma called the Mahasi Center, kind of like the mother temple for all of this. And she went there. I don't know when she went there, maybe in the 50s or 60s, and practiced there. And she's supposed to have been the most highly attained or realized person, or lay person, or person to come out of that monastery, a lay woman, this poor lay woman from India, who had a horrible life. If you've heard her story, she was on her deathbed when kind of given up on life, and somehow managed to get herself to a meditation monastery and turned her life around. And so I went up to see her, and she was really sweet. And she'd sit there on her couch or chair, wherever it was, and you'd sit in front of her. And mostly what she did was she'd bless you. You know, she'd come there and sit in front of her, and she'd put both her hands on your head and kind of say, you know, may you be happy and may you be well. And it was such a kind of like a hit of loving kindness and joy and happiness. And I was thinking about her today because someone asked her once what states of mind she had. And she said concentration, equanimity, and loving kindness, and that's it. So I don't know. That's what she said. And so I was thinking of that because we were supposed to think about the qualities of a Buddha from last time, and so that was her qualities that she identified in herself as being very, very stable and very strong in her. And from the little encounter I had with her, it wasn't that long. I was there maybe 15 minutes with her. I had no reason to doubt that. But, you know, 15 minutes. The Buddha said once that he gave advice on how you're supposed to check out a teacher or check out someone, whether they're, whatever. And advice was you should hang out with them for a long time, because it's only with hanging out with someone for a long time that you can really get to know them and know them well enough to see that their moral conduct and their understanding and their wisdom and their whatever is really counts for anything. Anyway, so, it's not something that happens quickly. So concentration, equanimity, and loving kindness. So what are some of the qualities of a Buddha that resonated for you this last week? That you identified? What do you think a Buddha must have for you in your imaginary reconstruction of the mind of a Buddha, the heart of a Buddha?
Non-grasping,
huh?
Indomitable questing.
Compassion.
Uh-huh.
Generosity.
Uh-huh.
A very broad perspective so that the relative importance of things is clear.
Looking inward.
Looking inward. The Buddha is the great introvert.
Simplicity.
Oh, I like that. Simplicity, looking inward.
But his spontaneity, he comes from his inner nature in every moment.
Kindness.
Spontaneity and kindness. Are they connected? Forgiveness.
I think the particular kind of courage that allows one to be honest.
The courage to be honest, I like that.
Kind of a sincere intention.
Non-harming.
Happiness.
Uh-huh.
Happiness of nature.
Uh-huh.
Maybe that all comes when you help all the others.
A lot of the others come on top of joy.
Did someone say concern for suffering?
Someone said compassion, and so maybe I don't know if they're the same or different. But you think they're the same or different?
Compassion would be recognition, let's say, of suffering, and I guess I was thinking of an overall concern for suffering.
Compassion maybe is the empathy you feel in contact with suffering, whereas concern with suffering is even when suffering is not directly in front of you, you have a concern.
Right.
Take it into account. There's a word that I want to understand better. A Pali word. It seems that we in the West use the word karuna, or when we say compassion, the Buddhist word we have is karuna for compassion. And from what some scholar has written, karuna wasn't the most common word the Buddha used for compassion. Karuna had to do with compassion in the context of the four Brahma Viharas. Metta, loving kindness, sympathetic joy, compassion, and equanimity. But the most common word he used was a word called anukampa for compassion. And I don't remember from the article what the distinction is between anukampa and karuna, but I'll find out. I like the word anukampa. What are some other qualities? Certainly, there must be more.
About the Dhamma eye.
The Dhamma eye. So what is that?
The ability to look beyond what normal people can see.
To look beyond what normal people can see. And what do you see beyond what normal people see? That's what you think.
To go, yeah, it seems to me he has the capability of going beyond time.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Going beyond time. Or time loses its sting. To go beyond illusions and appearances.
The appearance of things.
Uh-huh.
Recollection of past lives.
Recollection of past lives.
Gratitude.
Gratitude.
Mm-hmm. A good sense of humor.
I hope so. There are articles about the, you know, where scholars try to reconstruct the Buddhist humor because it works a little bit on puns and things that are kind of references that are very obscure for us in the modern world. So they're very hard to pull out of the original texts, and modern, you know, very monastic commentators or writers or translators often don't have that humor themselves. So it can, you know, it has a certain dry quality sometimes, some of the suttas. But some of the scholars say that actually some of them are quite, were meant to be quite humorous. So then the question is, did you spend some time this week finding those qualities in other people? So, you know, Buddha maybe ideally is like the person who has a sum total of all those things, which is pretty great. But any one of those things, I mean, people have those tendencies, don't they? Most of them, at least. So, and when we recognize that in someone, what are we recognizing? Are we recognizing Joe Schmo, or are we recognizing the Buddha quality at that moment?
It's a kind of shimmer that one can see in other people sometimes.
Uh-huh.
It's not connected to time or space, the space particularly. And sometimes they're better behaving than we expect of ourselves.
I find that sometimes I sense that when I meet someone or see someone, I see a potential there for something which is just under the surface or right there, kind of shimmering or kind of right there very brightly, that hasn't really been tapped or touched or recognized in the person themselves. But it's just right there, kind of, you can see kind of the Buddhahood, kind of, it's there, you kind of see it, it could come out, it's just right there. You know, you kind of root for them.
You have to know what to look for.
Well, we just listed a whole bunch of them.
I did an experiment with it when I saw it. I pointed it out to the person
at
work. Not in a public environment, but I was in a meeting and this person conducted himself really well and I admired it. And so I got him offline and I said, the way you handled that is so, you know. And I did that a number of times during the week to people, and they were very disarmed by it. They kind of softened.
Yeah.
Sort of like, at first it was, you know, what are you saying? Not work. And but they've been warmer to me since I've done it. They've been very warm.
Oh, Buddha qualities. Did we exhaust that topic? Anything else someone wants to say about this and reflections on it, thoughts on it?
I kept feeling that one of the really important things for me was that the Buddha was a human being, a regular human being.
Yeah.
That was the inspiring quality, was that everyone is capable because everyone is an ordinary human being. And not pushing that envelope into something larger seemed very important.
Right. And it's also interesting, if you read the Vinaya, which is the one of the canonical texts of early Buddhism, there's a story of all the how all the rules for the monks and the nuns came into place. And it's like a law book. It's all the precedent cases. And what it is, the Buddha didn't create any rules for the monks or nuns until someone did something that was not appropriate. So he said, okay, you guys, we need a rule here. So it lays down that case, you know. And sometimes there's an idea that the founder of religion or the disciples of the founder, you know, he must have kept everybody, you know, he probably enlightened everyone. Everyone around him was probably, you know, the great worthies and everything. I mean, some of these guys were just complete, you know. I mean, it's stories and it's over and over. There's like the group of six, you know, the mischievous group of six, and you know, and they just keep, you know, they just. So the Buddha says, well, you can't wear high heel shoes because that's kind of pompous. So okay, so they don't wear high heel shoes. So then they go off and make. Get colored shoes, and so you can't wear colored shoes because that's pompous. And then they go out and get, you know, I don't know. They find all these variations of shoes that kind of just to kind of show off in. Okay, you guys. And anyway, it's interesting to read how even the monks in the times of the Buddha, you know, were just people also, like us. And I actually find I take a lot of heart in that, because I feel that the what's offered for us through practice and through the Dharma is something that is really accessible to all of us. And there's many things we can say that's being offered, but there's nothing which is, you know, superhuman, nothing that's beyond our reach to taste for ourselves. So all those Buddha qualities, how about recognizing them in yourself, let alone recognizing them in other people? Because recognizing these kind of qualities is a way of watering the seeds within us. And it's very important to recognize these when they're there, our compassion, our gratitude, our kindness, our honesty, and all those things. You know, recognize them and water them and feed them and nurture them and honor them, protect them in a sense. So they can grow and become a bigger part of who you are, and so they can also become an offering to the world, your gift to others. And I like a little bit also this idea of talking about qualities, because we all have a lot of these qualities are something we all have. It can come and go in our life, or come and go in different intensities, but they're all something we have, so it's not something so esoteric and strange. And also because so in a sense, you know, a moment of joy, or a moment of non-harming, or non-grasping, or of kindness, in a sense, that's a moment of being perhaps enlightened, being awake. And so rather than looking for enlightened people, what some people prefer doing is looking for moments of awakening, or awakened states, awakened ways of being. And so it's kind of a fallacy to refer to that as an enlightened person. You know, now I got it, or that person doesn't have it, or whatever. But rather, oh, there, that was an awakened moment. And honor that moment. And then as soon as you say, oh, I got it now, or boy, look at me, then you don't have it. So I thought we'd talk a little bit more today now, or start talking about precepts. Because going for refuge and taking precepts are the two major pieces of the ceremony we'll do on the full moon night. Oh, by the way, I called the person who I was hoping we could use his backyard, and he's going to be gone during that time. So we have to find someplace else where we can do our full moon refuge ceremony. So if anybody has any ideas, you can come and talk to me and where we might do it. And I thought it'd been doing outdoors would be the nicest, I believe. Someplace where it feels a little bit private, so it's not, you know, you don't want to attract too much attention. We won't be so noisy, but you know, I mean, it can be a public park, but just.
Well, I'm thinking I live in a condominium and we have a nice area with that. I'll come talk to you.
Okay. So we have to find a place. And anyway, so the precepts are also part of the ceremony, and I see the precepts as being kind of intertwined with taking refuge myself, and that refuge is in part taking refuge in these qualities within ourselves, potentials and capacities within us. And precepts can be understood from many different angles, many different levels. But for me, at the most fundamental levels, the precepts are the expression of the wholeness that comes from an awakened mind, a compassionate heart, that comes when we kind of live from these deeper qualities of our life. That's the living perceptually, living out of the precepts or living according to the precepts, is a natural expression of our Buddhahood, of our enlightened nature. And there's, of course, there's other ways of looking at precepts. And there's precepts, one way of looking at precepts is that they're the rules of restraint. They're kind of cultural, customary kind of ways in which people take precepts. It's, you know, it's expected of you, or you're growing up in just this particular society and these rules are expected, and so you follow them because it's expected of you, or you're told that if you break the precepts you'll go to hell, and which Buddhists also tell their folks, right? It isn't just the Christians who say that, but most, you know, that's kind of not so popular anymore. And even in Asia they don't do that as much as they used to, but there was a time in Asia when the fear of hell was instilled in people. And that's one way of looking at precepts, is the kind of precepts of restraint. Another level of understanding precepts is the precepts of compassion, that if we're sensitive to the world around us and we feel empathetic or compassionate and care for the world around us, we'll then not want to harm someone else. We not want to take things away from them, which is theirs. We don't want to lie to someone because of the damage that creates. But then what I feel, what the deepest level of the precepts is not even for the sake of not harming anyone, it's simply who we are in our innate, deepest sense of who we are. And rather than seeing ourselves as having innate sin or original sin or something, the Buddhist point of view, if anything, is we have original purity, original enlightenment. And that if we can touch that and taste that and feel that and come out of that, let our expression, our intention, our motivation and our actions come out of that, that we will naturally, without any question, live a life which accords with the precepts. And I think that, you know, most or all of you have sat a lot, done a lot of practice. And I think a lot of meditation practice is one of the places. There's other ways of doing it, but one of the places where we touch some deep innate aspect of ourselves, perhaps purity or centeredness or wholeness or you name it, different ways of saying it, from which you understand, it doesn't make sense to go out and kill or harm someone or steal from someone or to lie. And it feels like a violation, a transgression on yourself to do that. So I like to say that precepts, healthy attitude towards precepts comes from sensitivity. Both sensitivity to others and deep sensitivity to ourselves. And I was struck today how easy it is to lose touch with our sensitivity. And there's different levels of sensitivity within us. So yesterday I had a full day. I went to Berkeley in San Francisco and down here and drove around and had a lot of meetings and people. And anyway, yesterday I didn't do my sitting, my daily sitting. And so this morning when I sat down, I was actually kind of a little bit surprised, because in sitting down and dropping into my body and feeling my body again, being more embodied, only then did I realize that I had hardly checked in with my body all day yesterday. It was kind of like I'd been disembodied. I'd been in my mind, and I was mindful of kind of what was going on, you know, more or less. But I wasn't. It was kind of like this sensitivity of at the cognitive level or in the communicative level of the world around me. But I hadn't really dropped down into my body and seen what was going on in my body. And it wasn't until I sat down today that I took that time really to check in and see what had happened in my body, with the life I'd lived and with the tensions that I'd carried out and held, and the ways I'd reacted and responded to the world were all held in my body, and I could feel them and feel them unwind and open up. So in a sense, you know, what had happened yesterday was I kept myself separate from my part of who I was. My busyness had kept me separate from my body. And also in a sense, there are times when we keep ourselves separate from our heart. And mindfulness is not only kind of a mindfulness, you know, awareness of mindfulness of what goes on in our minds and our thoughts. It's a very important part of mindfulness. But it's also, I think, bodyfulness, awareness of what goes on in our body. And also it's a heartfulness, awareness of what's going on in our heart, to be sensitive to life from all those three aspects. And there are three different aspects, three different areas and three different places to be sensitive to the world. And to learn what it's like to be sensitive from here, from the heart, is a delightful and a painful thing. It's great joy and happiness, and also a place where you can feel suffering and feel sensitive and feel vulnerable. This is the way I would prefer to understand or live, relate to the precepts, is they come out of that kind of sensitivity of a sensitive heart, a sensitive body, and a sensitive mind. And from that, then precepts become not a should, what you should do, and not a cognitive thing, you know, well, kind of equation, you know, of what's right or what's wrong, but rather something that's almost precognitive. Almost, it's almost like you know, if you you simply can't hurt someone if you're sensitive to the situation. If you become numb to the situation, it's pretty easy to hurt someone. I think most people who go around killing and harming people are pretty insensitive to the world around them, and probably to themselves also. But I was struck by, I've been thinking since last week when Pesha asked her question about the snails in her garden and killing and not killing them or not killing them. And you know, that's a very common kind of question around that precept, and it's one that's very well worthwhile discussing. But it's very often very useful to state the precepts in a positive mode, turn it around, and not just say, you know, don't kill, but rather understand the precepts as being to cultivate and encourage life, to feel the preciousness of life and want to somehow honor and respect and encourage the preciousness of life. So if to state the precepts positively, the first precept positively, is to say to be compassionate towards life, would you then have a different attitude towards going into the garden with the snails? Would the precept look differently for you? Would you have a different relationship to the question?
Probably what I'm thinking is that I have been exploring ways of keeping the snails away without killing them.
Uh-huh.
Like there's copper strips that you can use and things like that. Uh-huh. They're not as efficient as poison.
Right.
I'm kind of ambivalent. I'm more protective of my vegetables than I am of the snails.
Uh-huh.
I think saying it in that way relieves me of some guilt.
Uh-huh.
In killing them, or in killing, like I said, the mouse kind of stuff. But, you know, I was thinking of that even further guilt, because I have had a conversation with one of the members of our Sangha about killing people. And I said that I know that I have the capacity to kill if I were being attacked, and there was no other way I could get away or stop. I would protect myself, even if it meant killing. And this other person said that she would not. She would relinquish her life rather than killing a human being. And I could say that. just been thinking about this also, because there's a part of me that knows that that actually, as we all sit here, that our bodies are killing living beings as we sit, and we could not be alive, and that all living things, in a sense, I don't know, maybe not plants, I don't know, we don't plants do. But we have to kill to live, we have to kill a plant, we have to kill either an animal or a plant, we have to kill to live. And we kill bacteria and virus all the time in our bodies to live. And so I like what you say about the reverence for life, because I feel that reverence for life. And I'm alive. That means I need to feel the reverence for myself.
Also, yeah.
And I need to feel a reverence for anything that I kill in order for me to live. And for me, the thing is to then maybe to look at what I need to kill and what I don't need to kill, and have a whole lot more reverence in that way, you know, what is necessary, not to go beyond that.
Yeah.
Alan Watts once, the talk on that, which really was very profound for me at the time. I was not into any of this, but it was very profound, that talking about if you do kill something for your life, to really make sure that that's what it is, and you're not killing extra.
Uh-huh.
Maybe just for pleasure or whatever, uh-huh. but for life. And to have reverence for it when uh-huh. you do that, to mm-hmm. treat it with reverence.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
But I don't know how that fits into the
I think it's a beautiful way of fitting it in, because it's true. I mean, you boil water to cook your vegetables, and 10 million creatures have been killed just in the water. You know, there's a lot of life and death just, you know, in our body, and the water we drink and boil, and where we step, and you know, everything. So it's not black and white. It has something to do with, in Buddhism, with intention. And so what's the intention you have? So when you boil water, most people don't realize that there's all these microorganisms in the water. There's no intention to kill anything there. But the intention has a lot to do with it. And, you know, what are you trying to do? Is there intention to be harmful? Is there intention to harm something? Or is the intention to be protective and have reverence and take care of what you feel needs to be taken care of properly?
I've found in Native American practice dealing with this, the element is gratitude.
Mm-hmm.
And when you take a life to sustain lives, human or others, that you address the spirit that you have ended on this earth and thank them. The most common prayer before meals is thank you, and we are grateful for animal life, plant life, that gives itself that we may live. And that every time you're aware of taking life, and it's a kind of mindfulness
yeah.
of being mindful of what you have done and for what reason. And then adding to it both a gratefulness, they would say the buffalo would give himself, the buffalo would give herself to the hunter. And an animal was never killed without its spirit being addressed and sped on its way. And I think it's just a carefulness, you know, a principle of carefulness and of gratefulness for all the life that contributes to our life. Also, when you are thankful for your meals, you think of all the people that prepared that food before it even got to your table. Do you know what picking strawberries can do to your back? And this is mindfulness in awareness.
Yes.
And I've found it a great addition in my life to be introduced to that.
Mm-hmm. I recently read an extract of a book called Ambivalent Zen, and the man speaks of a conversation he was having with his Roshi. And the Roshi said, I don't know how this came into context, but if you're in the jungle and you're being attacked by a tiger, and you have your gun and you're about to shoot, and then you say, oh no, I'm a Buddhist, I can't kill. He said, that's not being Buddhist.
that being attached to being a Buddhist. And he talked about how he killed the cockroaches in the Zendo, which was in New York. He said something I don't understand. He said, I help the cockroaches and the cockroaches help me.
I've also known people who to pick the cockroaches up and put them outside.
Yeah, but he didn't do that.
There's a different. I mean, I think it's important not to judge people, but to realize, I think, how it can come from our sensitivity, and when it comes from our sensitivity and our reverence for life, what is a decision we make, and we'll make our own decision, but just that, you know, we make our own decision for ourselves. Yes?
Well, Gandhi said, live simply so that others may simply live. And my heart and live simply.
One of the points I wanted to make this evening, it's a simple little point, but it's very important for me, and that is that a sitting practice, a daily sitting practice, helps nourish or nurture the sensitivity from which we can understand the value of the precepts, or from which we can get a reference for the precepts in a way that's very different than just kind of rules, you know, good and bad or right or wrong or things like that. So what else about killing interests you to talk about? Bonnie?
Well, a couple of things that I thought about. One, sort of backing up things that I've been hearing people talk, is that in exploring this and then getting together on June 1st, that he's saying these things formally, that maybe in some regard, what I might be saying is that I'm making a commitment to be mindful of this, to continue to evaluate what this means in my life, mm-hmm. rather than coming to some, that at that point I will be making a commitment to
right.
some particular interpretation, because I don't feel like I can figure that out in a few weeks. So that sort of...
Or ever.
Stepping back, yeah. And I guess two things that came in my mind about this precept. I have two questions of abortion and suicide.
Big questions. And they're also, I mean, I almost prefer to answer it by the same thing. You evaluate each situation and from some kind of deep sensitivity and reverence for life, and come to one's own decision. Yes?
I guess I have a comment about this precept and all the precepts. And it has to do with approaching the precepts from a cerebral point of view, where, as opposed to, as you become more mindful and more connected with your Buddha nature, you manifest the precepts from a non-think point of view, and then all of this verbiage really doesn't matter, because deep down in your heart, the more fully you're expressing your Buddha nature, the more you just know, and you are, and you act, I mean, in accordance with the precepts. So I just wanted to express the non-cerebral approach to the precepts.
I thought that was kind of what we were talking about. I was talking about being sensitive and coming from the sensitivity of, for example, sitting, coming from that sensitivity, letting that sensitivity be the guide for the precepts rather than your ideas or your rules. This is a point that I feel often quite strongly about. So I'll just add this, in the sense that for me, I'd rather not make too strong a division between the thinking world and the non-thinking world, kind of deeper, and actually to include them all as a whole, so that the thinking world also is part of that sensitivity, is part of that. It's not separate from it. from the deeper Buddha nature or the deeper sensitivity to the world. And that's just maybe my own predilections or something, not to want to make a sharp categorical distinction between a cerebral or world of thoughts and the world of no thoughts. But what I thought, what I'd like to do now, if I was going to say if it's okay with you, but I guess I shouldn't be checking with you all the time. Because I think it's important that you all have a chance to speak, and it's a big group, and only a few people tend to speak. And so I thought we could break into small groups again of three, and choose a different people than last time, so you have a chance to talk with new people, and people you haven't talked to before. And I'm interested that you talk about your relationship to the precepts in general. If you want to talk specific about killing, you may. But in particularly, do you see a connection between your sitting practice, your mindfulness practice, and the precepts, and you're living a life from the precepts? Do you see that, and what do you see that connection is? So what's your relationship to the precepts, and what do you feel is the relationship between the precepts and the inner world of mindfulness? And again, maybe we can have each person can do it. Does that work well last time? Or you kind of more or less took turns, but it can be somewhat casual. You can ask each other questions, but let one person kind of have the floor, and then but every 4 minutes I'll ring a bell, and then we can you can switch. And so why don't we try again groups of three? Last time there were three groups of four. So anybody want to share about how that was for you, or anything you learned, or share with the whole group? Jonathan.
It occurred to me while we were talking, and that was in some ways, my meditation sort of can take on different phases, and if in some ways I can measure it up against how spontaneously I want to do things which happen to coincide with what the precept teaches,
yeah,
maybe I'm getting an indication of how to alter my attitude towards meditation to help it, to help me. It, as if using the how much I want to do the precepts,
uh-huh,
is a litmus test to how my meditation practice is doing.
Oh, I see. So when you're interested or sensitive to wanting to live ethically, then you're probably more settled in your meditation or more connected to it. But if you couldn't care less if you run that, that guy over, that's probably an indication that probably, you're not so settled into your Buddha nature.
Right, and there's an attitude I bring to meditation which can either encourage my desire to do the precepts,
uh-huh,
or it doesn't seem to have much to do with it at all.
Meaning that wanting to live according to the precepts can be a motivation for sitting?
It's associated with a certain motivation.
I see.
And like seeing that makes me want to encourage that particular motivation.
Uh-huh.
So it's not backwards.
Maybe not. Remember, I keep saying, that in Southeast Asia, the teachers will first teach you about the precepts, and then they'll teach you about generosity, and then they'll get around teaching about meditation. And we do it upside down here in the West. And that it points out something I think is very important about the precepts, is that precepts can be taken on as cues. They're indicators of something. And so if you find yourself about to break a precept, that's rather than seeing, you're a sinner or you're terrible or bad or whatever, rather you can see that as an indication, like a finger pointing at something, saying, look, there's something here you need to pay attention to. You're about to run this guy over. Chances are pretty good that you've lost touch with something really essential and very important that you think is for yourself. And so, it's like a wake-up call. Oh, I've lost touch. Maybe I'll take this indication as being an encouragement to get back in touch, to look back into that which I feel is essential and important. And that way the precepts are kind of a friend rather than this, you know, moral obligation. That's a nice thank you, Jonathan. Anyone else want to share with the group, the wider group?
I just feel like I took in so much that I can't formulate.
Yeah, it's fine. You don't have, no one has to speak. It's fine with me. We're supposed to be comfortable with silence. And nothing has to happen. I'll share two things, just kind of more incidentals. One is the Buddha gave a list of seven virtues, and they're kind of seven different families of kind of virtuous qualities, I guess. And the first one has to do with not taking life. And so it's the family of associated things with the first precept. So this first virtue is refraining from taking life, abandoning severe punishment and arms, weapons, being modest and loving, extending friendliness and compassion to all living beings. That's a nice, to associate all those with the first precept, I thought it was very nice. Abandoning severe punishment and weapons, being modest, loving, and extending friendliness and compassion to all living beings. And then there's the five precepts in plain English. The first precept is to show up. The second is to pay attention. A little bit on the second refuge, Dharma, and more about the precepts, and maybe the second precept, which is to take what is not given. And so you might, you know, just reflect on it in your own way, those two things. But Dharma means many different things. I remember Pesha asking the question once, but it means many, many different things. But so one of the things it can mean is things as they are. And the life of practice is supposed to be living a life in accordance with the way things are. And to take not to take what is not given is the second precept. I can see the connection between that. And you might experiment this next week with seeing things as they are and letting them be. And maybe you choose certain times of the day. You might choose like a 10-minute experiment to really radically, in some more thorough kind of, maybe even, you know, just a real thorough way, just see things as they are. And don't take what is not given about that situation, whatever that might mean. So set up that as an experiment. And yes.
Would you say just a little more about that? About seeing things as they are, and then you said, and don't take anything from that situation.
Don't take anything which is not given. So you're at work, and. And I know just now you're at work, and there's you know, your colleagues are having a little coffee break and having a nice, wonderful chocolate cake there, and you happen to walk by, and the way things are is that they're eating cake and you're not, and they haven't invited you, and that's the way things are. That's the way the universe is at the moment. And maybe normally you would have kind of made some, you know, hinted at how much you like chocolate cake, or you would have kind of hung out, or you would have walked away in a huff, or you would have done something, you know, and you know, you would have walked away in a huff, taking anger from the situation, just letting things be as they are, not manipulating the situation, not trying to change things as the way that, not trying to change anything for this short period, and don't make it different than what it is, and this can be done naively. But as an experiment, maybe it should be done naively. You know, you really, for 10 minutes, you know, or half an hour, you're going to try this. You just let things be as they are, and not try to manipulate or make them different according to your agenda, what you want, but rather just respond to the circumstances and let them give themselves to you and see what happens. Often we put ourselves in the middle of our situation with you know, our egotistical self, and everything refers to ourselves and what we get and what we don't get and everything. So put ourselves in the middle of a situation without that. And do it naively. You might learn a lot more if you do it naively than if you do kind of with your rational mind saying, well, I need to kind of take care of this properly, or, you know, or this is pretty good, but, you know, there must be exceptions. And make sense? So enjoy the Dharma.